It's 11 o'clock. Good morning. Welcome to Sunday View with me, Richie Allen, for July 7th, 2019. I hope you're well. Hope you've had a good weekend. Let's have a very quick look at some of the headlines in the news this morning. Looking at the BBC website as I speak with you, the Iranian government has announced it will break a limit set on uranium enrichment, which allegedly puts it in breach of the 2015 deal designed to halt its nuclear ambitions. The Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said Iran still wants to salvage the deal but blamed European countries for failing to live up to their own commitments. That's Iran. The Trump administration has been labelled inept, insecure and incompetent in leaked emails from the UK ambassador to Washington. Sir Kim Darroch said the White House was uniquely dysfunctional and divided under Donald Trump. But he also warned that the US president shouldn't be written off. The Foreign Office said the leak of the memos to the Mail on Sunday was mischievous, that's a quote, but didn't deny their accuracy. The US billionaire, hedge fund manager and registered sex offender Jeffrey Epstein has been arrested on new sex trafficking charges connected to allegations from back in the early 2000s. He was arrested in New York and will appear in court on Monday. It comes amid renewed controversy over a plea deal that he once reached to end a federal investigation against him. We'll talk about that a little bit later on in Sunday View. Jeffrey Epstein there. And the pop legend Stevie Wonder will have a kidney transplant later this year. He's announced on stage at the British Summertime Hyde Park concert. He said he found a donor and would perform three more shows before the operation in September, saying, I'm all good, Stevie Wonder. Welcome to Sunday View. My name is Richie Allen. In a couple of minutes, we'll take a look through the UK national broadsheet and tabloid newspapers. Good to be with you. Tweet at Richie Allen Show right now. Let's do it. Sunday View.
Welcome back to the most listened to independent radio show in Europe. It's your Richie Allen Show.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
I am the Richie Allen. I can't get recognised in my own street. Welcome to Sunday View. Thanks for tweeting me already. As those of you who are tweeting the programme, if you've got a comment on anything in the morning newspapers or anything else, simply tweet me now. All right. Loads to talk about. We might go beyond midday. I don't know. I hope not. But we might go beyond midday. There is a lot of things I'd like to talk to you about this morning. And I'm not even going to start with the newspapers. I want to start with the 7th of July bombing. Plural, allegedly, which happened 14 years ago. The oft-mentioned future Mrs. Allen and I had been living in Manchester for about 6 or 7 months. We hadn't. What's wrong with me? For just over a year, in fact. About a year and a half, actually, in 2005. Yes, a year and a half at that stage. We were living here and, like everybody else in this country, were transfixed by what happened in London and the round-the-clock coverage of it for the next week or two thereafter. 52 people killed, many hundreds injured. And you know, if you've listened to me for many years, I've been the biggest critic of what I call the truth or industrial complex. Wonderful term, coined by a journalist in Boston some years ago. The truth or industrial complex. Massive critic of the conduct of the alternative media. I am. But I will tell you today, and I will tell you until the day I stop making programmes like this, the 7th of July bombing, plural, in London, is a proven false flag event, attack, whatever you want to call it. I was convinced of it in the weeks afterwards. Convinced I was that none of the official story made any sense whatsoever. And there are a number of things I want to talk about today, because we never talk about it. the 7th of July today, 14 years on, and it isn't spoken about. The definitive book on it, and the definitive critique of it, was written by Nick Collerstrom, and it's a book called Terror on the Tube. That will trigger, of course, the Zionists who never miss this programme, by the way. Good morning, guys and gals. Are you well? I hope not. Hope you're choking on your cornflakes this morning. They don't like Nick because they label Nick Collerstrom as the Holocaust denier, which he might well be. I couldn't care less whether he is or isn't. But he wrote Terror on the Tube, one of the most important books ever written by an academic in this country. And it decimated the official account of what happened on the 7th of July. I remember reading it a couple of years after the attack, cross-referencing information contained within, checking it out, double-checking it, and finding he was telling the truth. But I only needed to look into the background of one of the alleged four terrorists, Mohammed Sadiq Khan, to know that the entire story was a crock of human excrement. Hugely important that we understand that the 7th of July is even more provable as a nonsense story than the September the 11th attacks of 2001. Look into the background of Mohammed Sadiq Khan, this lovely man, this man beloved in his community of Beeston in Leeds, loved for the work he was doing with children in Hillside Primary School. A man described as loving, kind, fair, decent, quiet, never spoke about politics or religion. Worked in community centres as well as primary schools, worked in youth outreach projects, was loved, had a lovely wife who was pregnant, lovely man, in every sense of the word, had nothing to do with terrorist cells or terrorist organisations, and most certainly had nothing to do with the events that took place on the 7th of July 2005, in my opinion. We're supposed to believe that they travelled to London by train. They got a train from Luton. They went from Leeds, didn't they? To Luton. And at Luton train station, they allegedly got on a 7:40 a.m. train to London. Of course, we found out soon afterwards that the 7:40 a.m. train had actually been cancelled, meaning that the lads would have had to get the 8 o'clock train into London, meaning that the lads could not have been at the respective train stations to detonate their bombs. Nonsense. The whole story falling apart with the train journey. Of course, the investigators then changed their story and lied. You know, it's what they do. They tell lies on top of lies on top of lies. And they put out doctored photographs, didn't they? But we know it's untrue. There were a few closed-circuit television camera pictures, weren't there? Just a bare few given to the public after the attack. To this day, those are the only pictures that were ever released, even though London and in and around London and London transportation centres are amongst the most videoed places on planet effing Earth. There should be tens of thousands of images of the four men in London, but there are none. Apart from the few they released to the public, the excuse given, well, CCTV cameras weren't working on the day, or that footage was lost on the day. This is true now. You know me, you and I have known each other now for quite a number of years. I will never invent anything. No truth or industrial complex member am I. This is true. Look it up. Can't find tapes, we lost the tapes, or, oh yeah, at that particular station, the CCTV wasn't working that morning. How convenient. How convenient. They found the passports, didn't they? They found the passports and other documentation on site where these bombs went off. Pristine, of course. Wonderful. They're supposed to have blown themselves to pieces to the point where there was little or no evidence they were even there. Disintegrated these men, but their passports and their driver's licenses were intact, of course. They love that one, don't they? The elites, they love that one. One of the bombs went off underneath a train, not in a backpack. too many witnesses to this, including a guy who told the Cambridge Evening News that as he was leaving his train, a police officer told him, mind the hole there, don't fall into the hole. That's where the bomb was. This is a man called Bruce Lait, L-A-I-T, look him up. Meaning the bomb went off underneath the train and pushed the metal upwards. Marvellous. 7th of July 2005. But the most compelling evidence, though, of all the evidence, and I'll never forget this as long as I live, the first time I saw this, was a man called Peter Power, a security consultant, a private security consultant working for a company called Visor. Peter Power now, right? Peter Power went on ITN News later that evening of the attack, the attacks, right? And said that a training exercise was taking place in London dealing with crisis management. The exercises were taking place on the exact same day of the actual attacks, but at the exact same time as well, and at the exact same locations. Every detail of the training exercise was the same as what happened in the three locations, right down to the bombs going off in unison. You don't believe me? I know that some people listening to this programme this morning will be aware of this, but many won't. Listen to Peter Power live on ITN News. This is the reason it got out, dear listener, because it was live. Neither the presenter nor the producer had the foggiest idea that Peter Power was going to say what he did say, because he was invited on to talk about the attacks and to talk about planning to make sure in the near future that the attacks couldn't happen again. This is why they brought him on. Mr. Power, you're a security consultant. What went wrong here today, Mr. Power? What went wrong, Mr. Power? And how, Mr. Power, can we make sure they don't happen again? And then Peter Power dropped this bombshell on the nation.
Today we were running an exercise for a company, bearing in mind I'm now in the private sector, and we sat everybody down in the city, 1,000 people involved in the whole organisation, but the crisis team. And the most peculiar thing was we based our scenario on the simultaneous attacks on the Underground and Mainline station. So we had to suddenly switch an exercise from fictional to real. And one of the first things is, get that bureau number. When you have a list of people missing, tell them. And so it took a long time.
Just to get this right, you were actually working today on an exercise that envisioned virtually this scenario.
Yes, yes. You could see the look on the presenter's face. He nearly fell off his chair.
Almost precisely. I was up until 2 o'clock this morning because it's our job, my own company, Visor Consultants. We specialise in helping people to get their crisis management response. How do you jump from slow time thinking to quick time doing? And we chose a scenario with their assistance, which is based on a terrorist attack because they're very close to a property occupied by Jewish businessmen. They're in the city, and there are more American banks in the city than there are in the whole of New York. A logical thing to do. And
how extraordinary today must feel for you as it unfolds. You mentioned a few moments ago there our experience with Irish Republican
Yeah. Isn't the presenter brilliant? He goes on to talk about how we have dealt with terrorism in the past when the IRA did it. Now, as somebody, dear listener, who has worked at every single level of commercial media, let me tell you what happens there. The producer was screaming in the ear of the presenter to fucking move on. No presenter in the world would leave that left on the table. Hang on a second. I just can't get over this, Mr. Power. Let's deal with this. How could you be running an exercise in London at the exact same stations where the bombs went off, at the exact same time, almost precisely, envisaging the exact same situation? Nobody in the world, Mr. Power, would believe in that coincidence. But the presenter moved on, didn't he, to talk about the IRA.
Republican terrorism. Yeah. And of course, it was very different, wasn't it?
Because yeah.
What kind of fuckery is this?
So it is the 7th of July 2019, 14 years on, and the vast majority of people in this country hasn't a Scooby-Doo that they were lied to then, and they have been lied to since then about other terrorist attacks, including the attack at Manchester Arena in May, what was it, 2016? Was it 2017? In May 2017, I think it was. We'll leave it alone, will we? Shall we look at the newspapers? Let's look at the newspapers. I had to mark the occasion. The Sunday Telegraph runs with, on its front page, "I'm not bluffing on no deal," warns Boris. Its lead story is an interview with Boris Johnson. He writes for the Telegraph, as we know. He says he isn't bluffing about leaving the European Union without a deal. He is bluffing, because he's not going to do that. The Sunday Express, "Britain will boom under Boris," is the front page headline. "Blow up, explode, maybe?" No, boom means it will thrive. The Express has spoken with Ian Duncan Smith, former Work and Pensions Secretary and a supporter of Boris Johnson. Smith reckons the trade deals are ready to go after Brexit. He promises a new age of prosperity, does Ian Duncan Smith, but for who? Now, the former Brexit secretary and leadership candidate Dominic Raab was on the Sophie Ridge show this morning. On leaving with no deal, which Boris Johnson claims he will do if necessary, Raab tells Sophie Ridge that it was explicitly contained within the last Tory election manifesto that no deal would be kept on the table. Dominic Raab.
It was absolutely explicitly in the manifesto. And it's incumbent on all of us as politicians to keep our promises. There's also then the practical side of things. We've had two attempts recently to take control of the order paper to deal with what are called the financial estimates, but basically government spending, and try and use that to choke the possibilities of leaving at the end of October. And so far they've failed. And I think there has been a dawning since the European elections that we've got to get this delivered. The thing that is holding Britain back economically, politically, in every way is this rut we're in. We've got to get out of it, and we won't do that until we deliver Brexit.
At the same time, though, you know, and I know, that there are many MPs, the majority of MPs really, who have said that they are against a no-deal Brexit. Do you think that proroguing Parliament may be something that a future Prime Minister would have to look at to get that through?
No.
Proroguing Parliament means suspending Parliament. Got to ask the Queen's permission to do it, of course. Suspending it and forcing through the no deal. So what does Raab say? Would Boris prorogue Parliament?
That's right.
No, I think it's highly unlikely.
But possible.
Well, I think it's highly unlikely, and Boris has been very clear about that. Highly unlikely and undesirable.
But he hasn't ruled it out, as you didn't rule it out when you
were running. Well, I think the issue about ruling things out is we want Brussels to have a very clear understanding, a very clear message that we'll leave at the end of October, come what may. And that is the way we give ourselves the best shot of getting a deal, which in fairness, I think most of us want. So if you take WTO Brexit, if you take walking away off the table, you weaken our chances of getting a deal that we want.
So is it a negotiating tactic then?
No, it's both. The principle of finality that I think the country needs so we can move on, but also it does give us, in any negotiation, whether it's a business negotiation, a diplomatic one, or a big political one like this, I think the other side need to know that you won't just accept any terms that they dictate.
So that effectively means that the threat to prorogue Parliament has got to be a genuine one then.
No, I just think you say more generally across the board, things won't be taken off the table.
I mean, some people would be really, really alarmed at this, that this is effectively overriding parliamentary sovereignty. Which is what, you know, the referendum was about.
No, I don't think so. Actually, what happened is that we, the politicians and MPs, gave to the British people the decision on this. And I don't think it's right, through all the shenanigans and devices and ruses that have been conjured up, that decision, which has been made by the British people, is somehow stolen back away from them. So actually, this is about a higher duty, which is to give effect to the promises we've made to the people of this country.
Dominic Raab. Then Ridge wanted him to comment on a statement made by Boris Johnson about migrants speaking English. She reads the statement from Johnson, just in case you haven't come across it yourself. But this is very interesting. This speaks to the PC agenda. Now, you know I've got no sympathy or any time for Boris Johnson, but it's very interesting this. Johnson made comments about migrants, about him preferring that people spoke English first, right? And she introduces this to Dominic Raab as if it's kind of somehow xenophobic. Have a listen.
And I wanted to ask you about something that Boris Johnson said at hustings this week. We'll just have a quick look at what he said. Too often, there are parts of our country where English is not spoken by some people as their first language. That needs to be changed. I mean, he's talking there about first language. He's not talking there about people who don't speak English at all. I mean, you're the son of a refugee.
Yeah.
Are you comfortable with that?
Yeah, I am. And in fact, one thing I'd like to see us do more of is support refugees into this country learning English. I talked a bit about that during the contest. I think it's crucial. In fact, you asked me about my...
But just be really good. Sorry, and I don't want to interrupt you as you're talking about your family history. But he's not talking about people learning English. He's talking there about people speaking English as their first language.
Well, I think you're over-interpreting that. I think what...
Well, here's what he said.
So you talked about my father. When he came here, the two things that made a difference, he didn't know any English, age six, 1938. The two things that made a difference to his life and his ability to contribute to this country was getting his English up to fluent level and then the educational opportunities. Those are two crucial things, opportunity and tolerance, that we have in this country. And actually, I think it's something, it's a two-way street. So I do think we need to do more to encourage and promote the learning of English so that actually people can contribute. And of course, it's critical to finding work. If you don't speak English, much harder to find work. So it's something which is in the interest of those that arrive here in whatever circumstances, but it's also in the interest of this country.
But I'm not talking about people learning English. Mm. I think this is quite important. We talk about there about people speaking English as their first language. Mm. They may have English as their second language. They may have worked really hard to learn English, but they may speak a different language at home as their first language.
I think you're over-interpreting that.
But that's what he said. Well, no. That's quite important detail. I mean, you're the details man, aren't you? That's what he said.
Sure.
Boris Johnson, a details man.
So what he's saying is people that come here don't have English as a first language. If their English isn't up to scratch, then that helps. I know what this is like. My wife came here and had to get her English up to scratch. It was good for her. It was good for my father. But also it's crucial for this country. We want to be an open, outward-looking country. We want people with talent, with ability, with huge amount to contribute socially as well as economically to come here. But learning English so that you can contribute, so that it is good for the people coming here, but it's also good for the UK as a whole.
So do you think that he effectively misspoke? He meant to be talking about people learning English, and instead he talked about people speaking English as their first language.
I think you're over-interpreting it, but...
I'm literally just looking at his words.
I know, but I think most people would understand that when you're talking about English, plenty of people would come here with English not as their first language, and they may be conversational, but actually they need to get it up.
Yeah, you know, I've got no time. I've already said it once for Johnson or any of them. But if Johnson meant, if he actually meant that he'd prefer that people living in this country used English as their first language, regardless of their level of English, regardless of how long they've been in the country, there isn't anything xenophobic about that, is there? But this just goes to show you how serious this politically correct or political correctness, cultural Marxist agenda really is. That anybody, even making benign comments like Johnson, that seems to be criticising anything around immigration, must be shut down to scare off people talking about this stuff. I made a similar comment on the programme about 2.5 years ago, and I had a volley of emails from people who said that I was being xenophobic. When I said that, I was on a bus in Manchester 3 years or so ago, and there was a family on the bus, and they were from North Africa, I think. And some of the kids were, I don't know, 6, 7 years old. And the mum was babbling away to them in their native tongue. And I made the point on the programme. I said that while I'm an Irishman and while I'm an immigrant in this country, I could understand why people, if they encounter that often now, if you find yourself on public transport or on buses and you are often confronted by people, or not confronted by people, but in the presence of people, not holidaymakers, but you know, settled people here, speaking in foreign languages, it could annoy you. Doesn't annoy me. I made the point. And I don't know what Johnson meant, but you can't say anything in this era of trial by Twitter and cultural Marxism and this lunatic progressive agenda, which is policed by political correctness. You can't say anything. I'd prefer to be surrounded by people speaking English. Would I, as an Irishman living in this country, would I be... Well, I don't care. Most of the people I am surrounded by do speak English. But People should be allowed to say what it is they want to say. That's how I feel. And if it's wrong, it's wrong. There's no harm in being wrong every now and then. The Sunday People front page. Cops vile abuse of Katie's son. Police have launched an investigation into allegations that police officers were mocking Harvey, the disabled son of Katie Price. They were caught doing so on video. And you'd have to say, not to be virtue signalling, but that's conduct unbecoming of a police officer if they're on video and they're mocking people with disabilities. It's not good. It's not a good look. If you want people to trust the police. But I would also argue, the police or police officers do a lot worse than mock children or young men with disabilities on video. But it is pretty nasty. The Mail on Sunday, our man in US says Trump is inept. The UK ambassador, these leaked cables I mentioned earlier on, where the UK ambassador branded Trump inept, insecure and incompetent, as if that is news. Trump doesn't have to be competent. He doesn't have to be intelligent. He just has to do what BB tells him to do. Through the back channel of Jared Kushner. What do they want me to do today? I'll do that. Can I just go back to playing on Twitter? Yes, okay, I'll do whatever I'm told to do. Now let me go back to trolling Bette Midler and Rosie O'Donnell on Twitter. That's where I'm most comfortable. All right? Open a bottle of champagne. Tell me what I need to sign. I'll sign it. That is who Donald Trump is. So, not exactly the most groundbreaking story of the weekend, is it? Is that he is inept. He's a complete moron, Trump. But so was his predecessor. He was just more... He was a better public speaker. That's about the only difference, really. The Sunday Times civil war rips apart captive Corbyn's team. Wow. The Sunday Times is writing about conflict or alleged conflict within the Labour Party. It alleges that senior MPs have told Corbyn to sack his advisers, including Seamus Milne, of course, long time of The Guardian. Sack him. Over this anti-Semitism row and bullying. The Sunday Times says Labour is embroiled in a civil war. And the Mail on Sunday writes about this as well. It says McDonnell, the Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell, whom we will hear from in a moment, and Diane Abbott have told Jeremy he must sack his closest aides. The two most loyal allies to Corbyn, McDonnell and Abbott, reportedly warned him his leadership of the party would be finished if he didn't act. Corbyn has been repeatedly criticised, writes the Mail on Sunday, over his Brexit stance and over his failure to handle anti-Semitism allegations. Okay? And I learned this morning, the BBC will broadcast Panorama on Wednesday, this coming Wednesday. Panorama is a flagship programme for the BBC. It's been around for some years. And Wednesday's edition will be an expose on Labour and its failure to deal with anti-Semitism. The BBC has spoken to people working within the Labour Party. Now, Labour is very concerned about this, to the point that it has written to the BBC before seeing the programme, accusing the BBC of interfering in the political process. You're shitting me, Labour Party, aren't you? That's what the BBC does. It isn't impartial. It isn't balanced. It isn't unbiased. You didn't just wake up to that now, did you? So they've written to the BBC in advance of the thing. They haven't even seen a screening of it, saying that they're not happy. So the Sunday Times, again, says that they've seen emails. It's all about email leaks. And that McDonnell and Abbott is the shadow Home Secretary, McDonnell is the shadow Chancellor, they've told Corbyn to sack Communications Chief Seamus Milne and Corbyn's Chief of Staff Katie Murphy because of their alleged influence over the party's Brexit policy. It was Diane Abbott who apparently told her friends that they are keeping Corbyn captive. Labour's polling figures at the moment are not very good. So John McDonnell was on the Mar show this morning. Just before I came on air, I did manage to grab it. McDonnell was first asked by Mar, is Labour's vague Brexit policy, where people don't know whether they do or don't support a second referendum, is that costing Labour in the polls at the moment? Here's John McDonnell.
I think it's been difficult to explain to people the sort of process we've gone through, because what we've tried to do, because you interviewed me before about this, we tried the most difficult task, which is to bring everyone together again, achieve what I used to call a British, you know, a very British compromise. Actually, that's not worked. And what's happened now is the middle ground has gone, and it's gone to either extreme of either remain or leave. And I think we've got now the debate in the party is that if we can't get a deal that will protect jobs and the economy through Parliament, we've got to go back to the people. And the issue is, yeah, of course, we want a general election, and that might happen. I agree with you. I think Boris might call one in September. But if not, of course, a referendum.
Now, Tom Watson, deputy leader of the Labour Party, has been promoting a kind of sign-up referendum motion. I've got it on the screen there, I think. And what he says in this is, as the party, this is a Labour Remain declaration, as the party of Remain, we will not take every voter with us, but it's the only way that Labour can win. The next step needs to be a public vote on the Brexit fiasco, with Labour leading the way for Remain. Is there a syllable there you could disagree with?
Very good question. John McDonnell purports to be a socialist. He's not got a socialist bone in his body, neither does Jeremy Corbyn, because no socialist on planet Earth could support membership of the European Union. So Tom Watson then has been a thorn in the side of Jeremy Corbyn for, well, for a long, long time now. He's a Blairite. He's a Zionist, is Watson. Disgusting, odious little man, Tom Watson. Another witchfinder general lying pathologically on a daily basis about the extent of anti-Semitism in Labour and in society. There isn't any anti-Semitism in Labour. There isn't any in society. I don't care who disagrees with it. There isn't. Right? So he's odious. And Watson is hell-bent on ignoring the will of the people as expressed on June 23rd, 2016, that we want to get out of the fascist dictatorship, the European Union. Jeremy Corbyn, of course, has been a Eurosceptic his entire life, as was John McDonnell. But now, do you agree with Tom Watson? Is there anything there you could disagree with? John McDonnell.
You could disagree with?
Not an awful lot, I think.
Tom, yeah, not an awful lot.
He's expressed his view. What I've said is,
yeah,
Jeremy has made it clear we're going to go back to the people.
Yeah, we're going to go back to the people, yeah.
People.
Until the people give us the fucking answer that we want. Yeah, yeah. We'll keep going back to them. We'll go back to them next year and the people will say, leave. We want to leave again. We won't tolerate that. We'll wait a bit longer and then we'll come back to them a third time.
In a referendum as well. I've said in the discussions, when people have asked me, what's your position? I said, well, actually, we have to be straight with people now. Haven't been up.
We have to be straight with people now.
Haven't been able to get the deal we wanted. So I would vote Remain. I'd want to...
Yeah, let's get rid of that. One more question for McDonnell before we move on. Makes me sick to my stomach to listen to him. On the claims that he, John McDonnell, and Diane Abbott told Corbyn to sack Seamus Milne, Andrew Marr put this to John McDonnell.
Can I ask you directly, have you said to Jeremy Corbyn that he should sack Seamus Milne and Carrie Murphy?
I've not said to sack anybody. Look, it's July. What happens in July in Parliament? Journalists, the lobby, stagger from reception to reception, drinking some of the most nauseating wine that ever been produced from a grape. What then happens? They exaggerate and invent stories. And that's what's happened here.
Journalists in July, they go from office to office in Parliament, getting pissed on dreadful wine, the worst wine ever extracted from a grape. And then they start making stuff up, says McDonnell. Now, I know, and you know, that journalists in the mainstream do spend most of their time making stuff up. I didn't realise that they were wandering around Westminster pissed as farts while doing so.
And here.
But you've got a lot of whistleblowers from the heart of the Labour Party, at the top of the Labour Party, been talking to the BBC, they've been talking to journalists, and what they say has to be listened to. I mean, these are important people, some of whom feel excluded, some of whom feel bullied, and they need to be listened to.
Well, there's two issues there. In terms of the Sunday Times story about any splits between me and Jeremy, it's myth, it's rubbish.
Have you not been frozen out a bit in meetings?
Not at all. Look, you don't know. Jeremy and I go back 40 years. We're the closest of friends. Mm. We've minded each other's backs all the way through that period, and we always will.
And you have full confidence in Seamus Milne and Carrie
Murphy. I have the confidence, and of course I do. I've not told anyone to be sacked or anything like that. This is all myth. But let's make it clear. Jeremy and I talk about policies on a daily basis. Yes, we'll disagree on things, but we'll then come to an agreement. He'll build consensus, just as he always does, and then we back each other up.
So you don't feel like Diane Abbott, apparently, that he's been held captive by his office?
That isn't... I don't believe that's what Diane Abbott has said anywhere, but let's make it absolutely clear. We're facing a general election in September. We're going to come to a decision, I think, sooner rather than later with regard to our Brexit position. We've got a huge domestic agenda that we want to promote, and I think we'll surprise people in the election just as we did in 2017, and we'll go into office as a united party.
John McDonald there. The time is 24 minutes to midday. This is Sunday View with me, Richie Allen. I want to say good morning to my new mate, Darren, in Salford, who listens to the programme regularly. How you doing, Darren? He's given me one or two really interesting ideas for discussions, for topics for the programme, which I'll be getting into in the next couple of weeks. Really interesting guy is Darren. Good morning, mate. Introduced to him through my pal Tez Terry Howell. We're going to take a musical interlude now. A little bit sad to hear about Stevie Wonder. You know I love a bit of Stevie Wonder. Stevie announced on the stage at Hyde Park yesterday that he's got to go and have a kidney transplant. He's found a donor, and that can't be nice, that. I don't know, maybe you might know somebody, you might have had a transplant yourself. Can't be very pleasant. Love old Steve. He's not so old, really. He's only 69. Is he, Stevie? 70, is he? So in honour of the great man, this is Sir Duke on the Richie Allen Show. Alrighty. It is Sunday, July 7th, 2019. I am Richie Allen. This is Sunday View. Brilliant. I'll read some tweets in a couple of minutes, then we'll see what's on the front pages of the rest of the newspapers, and we'll go in a different direction. Alrighty. Right, Stevie Wonder and Sir Duke on the Richie Allen Show, Sunday View, then it is. The time has gone up for 20 minutes to midday, Sunday, July 7th. Patrick tweets, McDonald, as in John McDonald, couldn't be straight if he was put through a steam press. He knows the nature of the European Union beast, but is indulging in party, political, expediency and tricks. His kind of dishonest, cowardly scum has no place in governance, says Patrick. Patrick, I'm tired of telling you, my friend, they are all the same, every one of them. All of them. Everyone. Everyone, every party. Every lobbyist. Every delegate, they're all the same. No change will ever come through engaging in that system and believing every 4 years when another hero emerges, pretending to be a socialist. Good morning to David Stanford. Good morning to Ricky. Good morning, Ricky. Good morning to David Mortimer. Good morning to La Antenna, to Paul Alawi, and everybody else who's tweeting. To Sarosh. Good morning, Sarosh. To Cunnington. Good morning, mate. Number of you tweeting about Jean-Charles de Menezes, who was murdered by armed police officers in London, who alleged that he had jumped over a barrier and hadn't paid to get on a tube. Because of the environment, this is very shortly after the 7th of July bombings, of course. It was alleged that tensions were so high, they got him into a carriage and they shot him 8 times in the head. It was an execution, I believe. I believe Menezes, who was an electrician, I believe he had some connection or some understanding of what actually happened on the 7th of July 2005. And I have no proof of that. It is just speculation on my part. Don't take it as fact. It isn't. But I believe that Menezes was executed, the young Brazilian electrician, because he knew something. And I believe that when he ran into that tube station that morning, he was being pursued, is what I believe, but I can't prove it. Good morning to Gail. Good morning, it's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Right, let's move on. On the front page of The Observer, secret plan to use charities to help deport rough sleepers. This is about the Home Office, which has drawn up, allegedly, a secret programme using homelessness charities to get sensitive personal data that could help them deport non-UK rough sleepers. This is pretty nasty if it's true. That being said, I know there will be people saying, we can't take care of our own people, Richie, if there are people coming to this country and they are not here legally and they are on the streets, maybe they should be back in their own countries. There will be a lot of people who will say that. And I'm not insensitive to that. I'm not immune to it. But it's still a bit nasty how they're going about it. They're breaching the privacy. They're breaching privacy laws. And they're treating these people like cattle. They're treating them as if they are kind of subhuman. And that's never any good. So emails were discovered that were sent from the Home Office in December 2018 up to May 2019, showing that this clandestine programme, which will use homelessness charities to find out data on these people who are rough sleepers, apparently it ignores European privacy laws by passing the rough sleepers' sensitive personal information directly to the Home Office without their consent. So the Home Office has basically gotten homelessness charities to agree to giving them data on rough sleepers, which is not good. And that's the story in The Observer today. If you want to read more about that, it is free. Just Google or use another search engine. Look up The Guardian, The Observer, and you'll find it. The Daily Star says Ripper has only weeks to live. Front page, Ripper has only weeks to live. That's the Yorkshire Ripper, Peter Sutcliffe, who murdered 13 women in the 70s. Apparently he's not well. He's got breathing difficulties, high blood pressure, and he isn't expected to live out the rest of the year. He's got diabetes as well. Huge story breaking over the weekend. Yesterday, Jeffrey Epstein, billionaire, hedge fund manager, friend of the Clintons, friend of Donald Trump's, even though the hairpiece denies it. Yeah. Friend of Prince Andrew, even though the palace denies it. Yeah. They smashed into his office over the weekend on Saturday. FBI agents. He was in France. He came back to France, from France even to the UK. Jesus, Richie. He came back to New York from France. Landed in New York from France on his private jet. An FBI agent smashed down the door of his office. They smashed down the front door of his house. And they served him, arrested him, and charged him with sex trafficking. Going back to things that happened in the early 2000s. He's going to be in court on Monday, Will Epstein. And they've been investigating him in the last few months, 5-6 months, looking into him. The Southern District of New York has been compiling a file and a dossier on Epstein, the convicted paedophile. So he landed at Teterboro Airport in New Jersey on Saturday, and they were waiting for him there, took him into custody, and they smashed into his place in the Upper East Side, a big mansion he has there. The Daily Mail is all over the story. It's got photographs. If you want to go to dailymail.com, that's free as well. Photographs of the search, including the smashed up front door of the mansion. This news comes only days after a judge ordered the unsealing of nearly 2,000 pages of records related to a civil case against Epstein that could reveal how he and his accused accomplice, because there's another woman, there's a woman accused as well, her name is Ghislaine Maxwell, and they are believed to have trafficked underage girls for sex. It's all true, of course. The documents that will be unsealed are from a defamation case that was settled. This is why we call Jeffrey Epstein a paedophile, without fear of being sued for libel, because he entered a guilty plea to a single charge of soliciting and procuring a person under 18 for prostitution settled a civil case. This has been unsealed. There's a massive amount of evidence around that, which contains links to and evidence that suggests that Epstein was doing it a lot, which is why the records have been ordered to be unsealed. I wonder how many celebrities and how many politicians are shitting in their underpants, wondering what's going to go on. Now, I'm not saying this is going to happen at all, but don't be surprised if Jeffrey Epstein commits suicide. Right? I don't want it to happen, and I'm wrong a lot of the time, so I don't speculate very often. But Epstein's connections to the very, very rich and the very, very famous and the very, very powerful might mean that Epstein might be better off dead. Watch it closely. Watch it closely. New allegations have been found in these unsealed records. And this is where you worry about the suicide, because they've opened up all these files pertaining to the single civil case which he settled. And in those files are allegations of sexual abuse made by numerous... Excuse me. Let me say this again. It's very important. So Epstein was arrested yesterday. House was smashed to shit and searched. This is a billionaire paedophile, very powerful man. He settled a case some years ago, admitted procuring a child under aged 18, said he was guilty and settled the case, right? Obviously, the other side had gathered volumes of evidence about Epstein, but also about some of his pals. So the unsealed records from the defamation case contain allegations against numerous prominent American politicians, business executives, foreign presidents, a well-known prime minister, and other world leaders. Jeffrey Epstein was flying some of the most powerful people on planet Earth around on his plane, which the press dubbed the Lolita Express. Right? Including Bill Clinton, who was on the plane 30 times. Clinton was on the plane without his Secret Service detail. You see, even when you've served your time as American president, whether you serve two terms or one term, you have Secret Service protection for the rest of your life. And you are also entitled to daily CIA briefings, even though you are no longer the president, right? Well, on many of these flights with Jeffrey Epstein, Bill Clinton decided to tell his Secret Service detail to piss off. I'll be okay by myself. Flying down to New Mexico. Flying to Haiti. So you have disaster capitalists turning up when a so-called natural disaster has wrecked a third world country. But you've also got the predatory paedophiles as well. Donated millions to the Clintons. Close friend of Donald Trump. He even hosted Trump in his penthouse in Manhattan. Close friend of Prince Andrew. They're all denying they knew him. Trump was lying through his teeth. And Trump's people. Trump even tried to fob it off on Clinton, didn't he? On Bill. Yeah, but we know that you know him as well, Donald. And we know you like the young ladies, Donald. We know that you don't care how young they are, Donald. Right? Right. Ah. Conchita Sarnoff works for a non-profit group called Alliance to Rescue Victims of Trafficking. She wrote a book called Trafficking, Why Would a Former President Associate with a Man Like That? Her book is called Trafficking, Why Would a Former President Associate with a Man Like That? Conchita Sarnoff. She is a credible woman. And she says, everybody in New York, everybody, certainly within Epstein's inner circle, knew he was a paedophile for a long, long, long time. And yet many very powerful people maintained their relationships with him. Why do you think that is? Because you, dear listener, and me, dear listener, we wouldn't be seen within 500 feet of a convicted paedophile or a known paedophile. Wouldn't be seen anywhere near him. Lest you might lose your temper and do something unspeakable to him. Or, if you're non-violent, because you couldn't stand the fucking stench of him. But even knowing that Epstein is a paedophile, some of the most powerful people in the world, business people, presidents are not powerful, they're puppets. And bankers maintained close relationships with Epstein. I wonder, will Jeffrey Epstein, in a fit of guilt and remorse, kill himself? Or, conversely, will he not do that and will he be cleared? We'll find out very soon. It's 6.5, 7 minutes and a half to the top of the hour. Here's an interesting story for you. It's in the Mail on Sunday. Parents are left furious as Christian pupils aged 10 are excluded from school for alleged homophobic remarks. Now, this is a very controversial primary school in London. This is the school that wanted the pupils to get involved in gay pride. Do you remember this school? It's a Heavers Farm primary school in Norwood, in London, South Norwood. It's been in the news for quite a while. It's very LGBT friendly. It's beyond LGBT friendly, right? This is Heavers Farm Primary School. And they've basically expelled a couple of children, alleging, the school alleges, that the children made unforgivable homophobic remarks. And they've named the children the Mail on Sunday. They are Christian children. They come from devout Christian families. Casey Frances Austin, little Casey, she's a girl. And Farrell Spence, a little boy, they're 10. They were expelled for 5 days, excluded for 5 days last month from Heavers after they were overheard making the alleged remarks. Overheard by who? Now, both the pupils say it didn't happen. They deny it. Flat out say we never said what we are alleged to have said, which I'll tell you in a minute. Their parents are disgusted. The parents are screaming bloody murder, saying this is outrageous. They cannot believe that the head teacher, a woman called Susan Pappas, took this action, kicking them out for 5 days. Now, apparently this all happened in a year 5 religious education lesson. The pupils were discussing their participation in an LGBT pride march the school had organised. This is why the school is controversial. It organised an LGBT pride march. These are 10-year-old children. Two of them come from devoutly Christian families. Maybe conservative Christians, maybe, I don't know. So young Casey and young Farrell told their parents they were speaking to one another. A chat between 10-year-olds. And they were saying, the 10-year-olds, that they didn't want to take part in the LGBT Pride March. That conversation was overheard by an unnamed woman who was observing the lesson. Not the teacher. Not the teacher, but an unnamed woman who was observing the lesson. So the head teacher wrote a letter to the children's parents saying that the unnamed woman heard the children say that gay people should die. The unnamed woman claims that young Casey said that gay people have let the devil into them and that they need to be killed. While allegedly young Farrell said gay people needed to die or go to prison where they would be shanked up. Shanked up means stabbed. The unnamed woman claims that she asked the children if they were suggesting that her black lesbian friends should die. And she alleges the unnamed woman observing the lesson that the children said yes. So they were kicked out for 5 days. So young Casey's mother is a Pentecostal Christian. Young Farrell's family are Catholic. They deny and totally refute the woman's claims. And their parents said they would never use such violent language. The children say they were trying to explain in the lesson how gay people would be punished for their sexuality in some countries, but that their point was misunderstood. The school refuses to tell the parents the name of the woman involved or even confirm whether or not she is a teacher. Wonderful. We'll exclude your children. We will say that the children were engaging in very hostile commentary or making very hostile statements about gay people, but we will not give you any opportunity to sit down with the woman who made the claims. Young Casey got a glowing school report last year. Denies being homophobic. She's 10. She says, I only learned what homophobic meant the other day. So I was confused when the head teacher said that I was being very homophobic. The Mail on Sunday says, this is the latest controversy to rock the school, which some parents have said has an aggressive LGBT agenda that conflicts with their Christian beliefs. So the school last year, of course, last summer, organised a Proud to Be Me parade for Pride, and it wanted all of its 750 pupils to participate, but they didn't. Not all of them anyway. These are interesting times. Aren't they, dear listener? These are interesting times. I'm going to love you and leave you this morning. That's it for Sunday View. Look after yourselves and one another. Have a fantastic rest of your weekend. I'm going to go out with this from the Lighthouse family. Tremendous tune called Ocean Drive. I've been Richie Allen. Speak to you tomorrow morning at 9:30 for the Monday paper review. I love you, by the way. Have a great day. Speak tomorrow. This is gorgeous. What a song this is.